I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a look at urbanism in Dallas and how the city can promote organic growth. Instead of fixating on big box stores, chains, and shopping centers, some argue that just adding more duplexes to the residential landscape, encouraging walking, and fostering pop-up markets might be a better way to invest in parts of Dallas that need a boost. We'll talk to DART board member and D Magazine contributor Patrick Kennedy and Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia about a city known more for horsepower than hoofing it, about where the city is headed, and about where it should be. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Dallas's web of interstates and highways transformed the city in the 1960s, allowing people and families to prioritize cars and spread out. But recently, the commuter city identity has been challenged. Residents are gravitating back to the urban core, and people with knowledge of city planning say there's a right and a wrong way to handle that. D Magazine recently devoted an entire special issue to urbanism and will tomorrow host a symposium on the topic. State Representative Rafael Anchia and DART board member Patrick Kennedy will both be there, and they join me now to talk about Dallas's urban identity. Rafael and Patrick, welcome to Think.
Hi, Courtney. Thank you.
So I want to kind of pose this first question to both of you. When you look up the word urbanism, the first definition you get is something along the lines of the way of life characteristic of cities and towns. What do you think that means? Rafael, what do you think?
When I think of it in the context of new urbanism and urban design, I think about the articulation of the physical environment to the individual, right? I think one of the things that that holds Dallas back in a way is that this is a very car-centric design, and Dallas is made for cars and for cars traveling long distances. So when I think of urbanism, I think of rethinking the physical environment so that it allows the individual to experience the physical environment in a way that gives them more options and opportunities.
And what do you think, Patrick? The way of life characteristic of a city and town, it sounds like it should be what it is, wherever it is.
That could literally mean just about anything. So it doesn't really mean much to me, and it becomes sort of the eye of the beholder. To me, I would define it as, you know, break it down to the root word of urban or urbs, which is people, and it becomes about place for people. So we're talking about urbanism being designed for human habitat. And, you know, we're all different in different ways, but we all are very similar as well. And I cover that in the issue talking about sort of Maslow's hierarchy needs, that we all sort of have the same kind of needs. But we all have different kind of wants and tastes as well. And so we have to build for all of those kinds of wants and tastes in a way that works, in a way that's economically and financially and environmentally sustainable. And so that means having, you know, low density housing, single family housing, having high density housing, also having everything in between. And when we get into a place where we have too much of that, any sort of sector of that range or density sort of gray area, we need it starts to distort the market, and that's where we end up with these issues where we have walkable urban neighborhoods, which is sort of what the Congress for New Urbanism supports, that when there's not enough of it and demand exceeds supply, we get to a point where it starts to price out all the people who want it, and we have to deliver more of that.
So, and to that end, I guess urbanism is going to mean something different for every community. I mean, it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all where we apply some definition of urbanism to Dallas and it translates to every community in North Texas. I'm guessing it's going to evolve depending on the needs of each community.
No question. And a lot of times you hear about these delegations that Dallas takes to other cities, and you know, and they're looking at how other cities do things. And I think that's instructive and can be inspirational. In fact, we should be doing that. But what always gets me is when people say, well, we just need to plop, you know, what they've done down in Chicago here in Dallas. And it really won't work. If that's your point of departure, it's not going to work. We need to do things that seize upon the creativity that we have in this community, seize upon the people that we have in this community. And while we can be inspired by things that other folks do, we can see their successes and their failures so we don't replicate them. I think that the how we solve for changing Dallas, it has to be homegrown.
So, Patrick, you're a panelist tomorrow at the symposium, and you're discussing the transition from kind of commuter to residential city. When did Dallas kind of really crystallize as a commuter city? I'm guessing it had to be with the advent of some of those big construction projects on the road, right?
Yeah, I think it was largely due to the Interstate Highway Program that was implemented by President Eisenhower in the 50s, who incidentally never intended the highways to go through the center of cities and displace existing neighborhoods. They were supposed to link regional economies, which they did, but we sort of overbuilt them through cities and ended up sort of creating barriers, not just because highways are difficult to cross, but also, it created a barrier of distance because it started to spread out the real estate market. And this was largely a phenomenon mostly in the Sun Belt cities, which were fast growing in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and still today. And it meant about growing out and increasingly further and further apart. And what that's led to is that cities like Houston, Atlanta, and Dallas have the longest length of commute in the entire country. And that means that really only one form of transportation ends up working. And it often ends up meaning, especially in Texas, where we're a property tax state, it means that a lot of times people are taking their tax base where they own property and living outside the city of Dallas and commuting in. And the real challenge becomes eventually the business owners and management people who may have moved out of the city, they say, well, why am I commuting so far? I'm going to bring my business out closer to where I am. And then we end up with these real land use imbalances, not just where people live and work, but also by income and how people have to commute around to get to those places that keep getting further and further apart.
And like you said, obviously, there's a lot of cities, you know, in the Dallas size area or nearby that have highway systems. But I've always been kind of struck. You know, I grew up in Florida, and there's certainly interstates in Tampa and Sarasota where I grew up. But you can't get over sometimes the high-rise crisscross in Dallas. My four-year-old mentioned it. He saw the high five for the first time and did not know what it was. I mean, are people just kind of blown away by the network of you know, high-speed highways and interstates we have right in the middle of where people work and live?
Yeah, I think everybody that I talk to that comes and visits, they're sort of overwhelmed, and I don't necessarily say that in a positive sense, because you know, you come here and it's your only way to get around, and that's difficult for not just residents but also for visitors, because it's like, well, how do I get to where I'm going? Because you know, I may be at a convention or a conference or want to go visit something or go see a different restaurant, and they would have to rent a car and find a parking space, and that's not necessarily convenient. But then it's also for our residents that live in the area. We say, what, 50% actually own a car? How many people can actually afford to own and operate a car? Well, it means everybody under 16 is then dependent on somebody else to get them around. Everybody over a certain age is dependent on somebody else to get around. People that can't afford a car, how do they get around? And when land uses start to get too far away from each other, or as a DART board member, if businesses or jobs are outside of our service area, how do we help people get to those things? And that's sort of the difficult challenge that we have to do. And I think the real opportunity is not how do we expand our system, since many of those cities that aren't members are using their penny sales tax for economic development. We have to say, well, how do we get more jobs, opportunity, and access to all of our daily needs closer to where people live?
And that's a question I was going to ask you, Raphael. I know your district touches a bunch of different communities. I mean, you have part of Oak Cliff, you have part of West Dallas, you have some of Farmers Branch, I believe, in Irving, too. Is that right?
That's right.
So I'm just wondering if you hear from constituents about this. I know we have a series we're in the middle of right now. We have a person in the series who lives in Jubilee Park, which is kind of that little slice between I-30 and Fair Park. And he works at the Home Depot Distribution Center, and it would be about a 20-minute drive, but it's so inaccessible from his house that he walks to a DART stop, takes two trains, two buses, and it's like about a three-hour journey, and he does it 4 days a week. Do you hear this from constituents? I mean, are we having people that, because they don't own cars, they just can't get to where they need to go, or they have to change their lives to suit that?
Well, yeah, no question. You hear about it all the time. And whether it's communities that are impacted by these, you know, mammoth interchanges that are built in their midst, like basically in the Asian Trade District, we just built this huge flyover in and around it that I think is going to inhibit development in, you know, off of Stemmons and Royal in the future. Whether you're talking about transportation meaning opportunity for people, and systems that may be Byzantine, that may not connect with each other, that may not be efficiently linked, that inhibits someone's ability to get around. Like yesterday morning, I was in Austin with my daughters, and I was taking them there at this college prep program at UT, and there was a horrible downpour. It was really, really bad. And they were complaining that their shoes were getting wet and everything like that. And I said, look, I want you to notice all the people who are at bus stops right now in this really, really bad weather and how hard it must be for them to get where they're going, to brave the elements. And if they have a child to, for example, get that child to school or to a caregiver, it's really, really difficult. It's a big logistics operation that you're running out of your home. And then when you throw a curveball like torrential weather into it, it was tough. So my daughter said, well, let's stop and pick people up. And we did. We stopped and picked people up on the way to
Chia Transit Service.
That's it.
Rafael, to that end, talk to me a little bit about the panel you're moderating tomorrow at the D Magazine Urbanism Symposium. It's called Reclaiming Our Urban Identity, Dallas's Competitive Advantage. So first of all, what is our urban identity? And reclaiming suggests that we lost it. When did that happen?
Right. And identity is tricky. When we had our panelist call, I asked everybody, I said, what is our identity as Dallas? And whether some people had an immediate reaction that we're a young, vibrant city. Other people saw it through a racial and ethnic lens. They saw us as a segregated city. Some people pointed to the last census and said, well, we're less educated and poorer as of the last census than we have been. Maybe that's our identity. So I'm not sure that there's a single answer to any of that. But what we're going to try to tease out and with the help of the panelists is, who do we think we are now and where do we think we're going? And finally, if there's agreement about where we're going, how do we get there? And we've got some really, really smart panelists who are going to walk us through that.
Patrick, what does Dallas have going for it that maybe makes this a city that has room to grow and kind of redefine its communities? I mean, we certainly know there's low unemployment here and there's certainly a lot of business interest in Dallas. Does that help or hinder? Or what does Dallas have on its side?
I think there's sort of two scales of competition there, because all cities are invariably in competition with each other for talent, for capital, for businesses, jobs, all of those things, that there's one sort of the national competition versus other cities. And in that sense, we've got the growth engine that's happening here. And then when we look at it sort of a local competition between the various cities of North Texas region, in order to capture more of that growth, more job growth, more talent, attraction to the city, more opportunity, I think what Dallas has versus other parts of the growing parts of the region is that it has history, that it has culture, that it has historic fabric, that it has, transit, which other areas don't. And I think that means there's a real opportunity to capture more of that growth, to bring it into the city. And, when we talk about the region being 11 million people, Chris Leinberger, who's a researcher and scholar at George Washington, who's going to be on my panel tomorrow, he talks about how potentially that 4 million or 95% of that new 4 million people that are coming here could happen in less than 2% of a land area. We're not predicting that in terms of our policy proposals, but we actually can handle that much growth coming back inward, not just to the city, but to all of our local cities. And we frankly need to increase our tax base to maintain all of our aging infrastructure and institutions. Something I like to use in my talks is that all of Greater London could fit inside Dallas County. That's how big our area is. And the question is, can we afford to keep growing out and double in size geographically? Or do we need to make areas more livable so that people can live next door to each other?
Yeah, go ahead.
And if I can add to that,
please.
One of the advantages that we have is we really still are a blank canvas. I mean, there are large swaths of this community that remain underdeveloped or undeveloped. And while we oftentimes will suck up a lot of oxygen talking about the negative aspects of that, there's also a lot of positive. We can catalyze neighborhoods. We can start anew. We can plan things better that are more responsive not only to the environment as we find it today, but the environment as we see it evolving with changes in technology, modes of transportation, et cetera. So, I think there are a lot of things that we need to keep our eye on, but the fact that we do have a blank canvas in Dallas gives me a lot of hope and optimism for the future.
My guests this hour are DART board member Patrick Kennedy and Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERAThink. We're talking about Dallas and the new urbanism. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Our guests this hour are Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia and DART board member Patrick Kennedy. They're both going to be involved in tomorrow's D Magazine's Urbanism Symposium. So that's the first thing I want to talk a little bit about. Patrick, you just recently wrote a piece in D, just did a special issue on urbanism. But you talk a little bit about kind of the model for development in Southern Dallas. And the first thing you assert is that getting like a Starbucks or a Mockingbird station in those neighborhoods isn't necessarily the perfect sign of success that people assume. So explain why that is.
I think Representative Anchia sort of referred to that when he said we're not trying to copy places from other cities because it doesn't work. It's not authentic. Places have to be sort of more of an expression of themselves. And in that piece, what I was saying is we need to mimic not Bishop Arts as it is, but the process that produced Bishop Arts. And we learn from that to allow places to be what it is, which is really sort of the suburban downtown of downtown, right? So it's the downtown of its surrounding neighborhoods. And it was to take sort of the bones of what it is, sort of, which is it was a historic streetcar suburb that was developed originally as Dallas Land and Loan, which, you know, people, private business interests would buy land and then build a private streetcar out to it and then develop around it. And then it took some infrastructure investment to make it more walkable. They changed the development code to reduce the amount of parking that you need to require, so you don't have to park on site, that you can then build a restaurant without having to knock down the building next to you. And it allowed for clustering, and clustering of businesses allow people to then say, I want to go to that area, not to that one restaurant. So they get out of their car or they take the streetcar that runs down there and they walk around the area. And that's really what creates the value. And in that piece, I found 9 other places. We really had 12, but we had to cut it down to 9 that had similar bones, that they have historic fabric, that at one point in time, transportation engineers said, let's move cars through there as quickly as possible. And it really ended up decimating the neighborhood. But there was still, to this day, sort of stable working class and middle class neighborhoods surrounding those areas. That means there's a market nearby. That means there's need for that third place where people spend time that's not work or at home, where they go to meet other people and spend time. And so it's about transforming places that we used our roads through there to say, these are now places to save time, but now these are places to spend time. And they become sort of the center of gravity for communities.
And Rafael, since you work and hear from constituents regularly, talk to me a little bit about why, in a tangible way, just saying, plunking that big investment down in a neighborhood that could use a little, you know, redirection, why that just doesn't work. Why saying, oh, we just need a super target and then we've got it made. you know the people who live in these neighborhoods. Why isn't that the answer?
Well, if you listen to the neighborhood, they'll usually give you the right answer, right? I mean, if you spend time doing charrettes, community meetings with neighbors, they'll tell you exactly what they want. And it's usually not the super target. There was a big investment, transit-oriented development investment made in the Bishop Arts area. And the first rendition that the developers came up with fell flat. Like the constituents hated it. They didn't want it. And I've lived in North Oak Cliff now for over 20 years. And actually, I'm a neighbor constituent, Patrick's constituent of mine.
I represent you now?
You might. On the dartboard, you do. Folks quickly said no to that. And the developer came back and said, you know, we hear you. Let's build something that will add value here, that you like, that you want. And it ended up being a pretty big success. Oftentimes a super target is all you can finance in an area, but if you have folks that are willing to take risk, early risk in places and catalyze neighborhoods, then market capital will follow on. And with the collaboration of the neighbors and the neighborhood elected officials, you can build something really, really great. And Bishop Arts, by the way, I don't think we need to replicate Bishop Arts 10 times around the city. I think, as Patrick said, you need to sort of take that Bishop Arts process in a box and replicate it 10 times around our community. But there's some real opportunity in the southern sector to do this.
I think there's also an important point to be made about not just what the neighborhood may want and need, but also what is best for the city and the municipality as a whole. I looked at different land use types throughout Plano to say which land uses perform the best in terms of property taxes generated per acre, sort of per land area, rather than just saying, hey, this super target produces X amount of jobs and X amount of property taxes. There's an economist named Joe Minicozzi who says, if you measuring property tax performance without measuring land area in that is like measuring gas efficiency of a car by the size of your tank, mm-hmm. right? So it's not really about fuel efficiency at all. And what I found was that the best performing land uses in all of Plano, which there's a lot of growth, was actually downtown Plano, historic downtown Plano, where it's sort of like the 2 and 3 story businesses, like Urban Crust, if anybody's familiar with that kind of place. That's what produces the most amount of property taxes, the most amount of jobs per acre, is that sort of small scale historic mixed use. Right behind that is the larger scale mixed use developments like Legacy Town Center. But what doesn't perform is sort of the single family developments, it's the strip center retail, it's the single-use office parks. And if those things aren't producing enough property tax per acre, it means there's this sort of slow loss of money to the city that they have to compensate elsewhere or some other way.
So density is kind of the word there.
Density buys amenity, and yeah.
talk to me a little bit about, Patrick, what you kind of talk about swarming an area with investment. That doesn't, I mean, people might think that means like some sort of sprawling giant, you know, construction project, but that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about an alternative to just big investments.
Yeah, and Representative Anchia sort of referred to that the institutional investors aren't going to pioneer into an area. There's just too much risk. And so the part of the point of the article is breaking down all of the barriers to investment and revitalization. And I think there's an important point to be made about this is not about protecting areas from gentrification necessary and saying gentrification can't happen, because areas are always either going to get better or worse. So the question is, how do we take investment, or how do we first catalyze investment and then harness that investment so more people can benefit from it, can be a part of it, so it's inclusive growth rather than sort of exclusive growth and pushes people out. And the point of the swarm is to say, one of those barriers is obviously risk. So how do we mitigate risk of the small developer? So how do we get the guy that just wants to do sort of a flip of a small building, a small retail building, or do some townhomes or a duplex product or something like that, and put 10 of them together in an area and allow that to mitigate risk, because you're starting to cluster those investments. And when you start to cluster, then you're catalyzing the area.
Like King's Highway happened in North Oak Cliff, mm-hmm. right? You had a guy who was an architect who started assembling fourplexes and sixplexes. And before you knew it, he had almost the entirety of a street called King's Highway in North Oak Cliff. And then that provided rent comps for other investors who wanted to come in and say, hey, Rick is getting these comparables. I can now get a loan to finance my multifamily development. And then once these small mom and pops get done, then you see market rate capital coming in, much more institutional capital coming in. And that's when, by the way, that government needs to get out of the way, mm-hmm. and no longer catalyze that neighborhood. It's done. Market rate capital's coming. Move on, right? Go to another place that needs those risk mitigants that oftentimes government can provide, mm-hmm. early on, and then let the market rate capital come.
And since gentrification came up, that's always going to be a question that kind of is laced through any talk about redeveloping an area. We got a question via email, and I'll pose it to either of you. But Paul wrote and asked, how will those living in dilapidated single-family homes in the neighborhoods near Fair Park, for example, be able to live where they are now if new urbanism takes hold throughout the city? Will they be forced to sell? Where can they go on a limited income? And again, that was Paul from North Branch, Texas. What do y'all think?
Well, I think he kind of answers that by saying the dilapidated single-family house. So the real question is, how do we get people into better living circumstances? How do we improve the overall housing stock? And that's sort of comes with the notion of encouraging investment, but encouraging the investment that ends up creating a place that's more diverse, that's more inclusive, and that more different hands can work on the projects, can get jobs out of the projects, and can be property owners as well. And I think that's one of the lessons we learned from West Dallas was the more people that you can have owning the property rather than renting the property means they have power to say whether they want to sell or not. And we see that in the Bishop Arts area, where people had bought for $20,000 or $30,000 20 years ago, and they're selling for $300,000 to $600,000 because those people had that, they were empowered that way. So the good for them, and they can go live and improve their housing stock wherever they want to go. The flip side of that is there were renters in the area too, and we do not know, are they ending up in a better circumstance now or not? And that's a real opportunity for us to sort of improve that process as we start to revitalize other areas of the city.
So let's say you've got a street with five of those dilapidated homes, and you suddenly create some density there with some rents that are kept artificially low. You can do this through city subsidy, or you could take part of a, if it's in a tax increment finance district, for example, dedicate some of that to buying down rents for affordability. But on the aggregate, suddenly, let's say you had two people per house, five houses, 10 people. Let's say you put 100 people there now in a really nice sort of class A, class B multifamily development where the people can stay in the neighborhood, yet you have mixed income and you have folks who don't have to go anywhere. The key is buying down that rent for the affordability, because that the developer is going to need to build that into their model.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Since we've kind of touched on this a couple times, the idea of, you know, fourplexes and duplexes working well, can you guys explain kind of the concept of the missing middle housing? I've done a couple stories on this, and it's really interesting. If you don't know about it, you don't know about it. I mean, when someone explains it, it makes perfect sense. But why does density work, and what's missing middle housing?
Sure. So missing middle housing is everything between sort of the single family and the high rise almost. So the market has gotten really good at delivering 250 unit buildings and up, or large master plan single family communities sort of out at the edge of town. But we haven't been good at, mostly because of regulatory barriers in the way, also as well as the sort of the time and effort and brain damage it comes to develop. It's the exact same to do four townhomes in terms of sort of the permitting process, the design process, all of that, for much lower margins than doing a high rise. So once you're developing, you might as well go big if you can get that kind of capital. So the missing middle ends up being the twoplexes, the fourplexes, the townhomes, and all of that sort of low-density stuff. And that gives us the range of housing types that helps deliver not just range of neighborhoods, but mix of housing type. It provides more choice and also greater affordability levels. So it's not just sort of one homogenous price rate per sort of submarket or neighborhood.
It is the basic idea that, I mean, if you had a single family home on a corner or a fourplex, I mean, you have four families in one and one in the other, and that changes how the tax base works and
right.
buying power and all that.
Right.
So, Raphael, Oak Cliff's pretty good about middle housing from what I understand. I remember a couple of years ago I went on a walking tour with a group that was in town at a conference, and they were kind of pointing out all the diversity of housing types in Oak Cliff. Is that something that you've seen both as someone who lives in the area, as someone who represents the area too?
Yeah, no question. And it's one of our strengths, candidly, is that diversity of housing. And I've been happy to see, we have our fair share now of very large multifamily developments that are coming in the Bishop Arts area. But in and around it, I've been happy to see fourplexes, townhomes, garden homes popping up. And, the community and policymakers just need to remain vigilant that you have that diversity of housing mix so that you can have all kinds of different folks living in that same place and achieve that mixed income balance that everybody's trying to get to.
Patrick, explain this to me, and this is something I'm sure can be a little bit wonky, but why are things like parking space size requirements so onerous when you're trying to kind of redesign neighborhoods?
Yeah, because when you have parking minimums, which means that if you're going to do a restaurant, city code says if you've got, for every 1,000 square feet, you may have to provide 10 parking spaces. Now, 10 parking spaces ends up meaning 3,000, 4,000 square feet of land. And so you have to find that land to put that parking. So that's an extra cost. And then providing that parking is a cost. And it's also an opportunity cost because you're not providing rent-producing property on that space too. And so it really ends up sort of, one, it's an extra cost on the investor. Two, we can accommodate that accessibility that parking offers that people can get to businesses in the public realm. And we see that in Bishop Arts. People complain about it, but that's exactly why it works, right? So people are willing to walk a block or two blocks or take transit to get there because it has that level of desirability. And so we have to sort of flip that because the market can figure out how much parking it needs. We don't necessarily need to say, you must provide this amount of parking because it actually ends up damaging our neighborhoods.
Does that make people just give up sometimes that have a plan? And is that enough to turn people off to making the investment or building the development at all?
I don't know if it's necessarily that, because once people sort of have it in their mind that they want to do it, you know, they'll make it work. What I think the real problem is the durability of that investment in that building, because if it's just sort of all about, hey, we've got free parking here to offer, is that really a lovable place that people want to return to? You know, do people want to go and walk around and shop and spend money? Because it's not a place we don't spend time. But where people want to spend time, they end up spending money as well, and that creates for better business.
And Dallas is kind of known for free parking, right? I mean, I thought I read something that like 90%+ of, you know, voyages will end up in a free parking spot. And that's not true in every city, right? I mean, we have many, many cities where you're either paying or you're walking or you're, you know, finding some garage somewhere.
Yeah, you won't drive. I mean, I was with my daughters in New York recently, and there was no way I was renting a car there. There was no way, right? Parking, if you were going to park at the hotel, was going to be like $50-$60 overnight, right? It was much more convenient to take the subway. We went to the Yankee game, we took the subway, right? And that was eight people who hopped on the subway. I thought it was good for my kids, by the way, to go on the subway.
They probably loved it.
They loved it. They thought it was a total spectacle. They loved it. But because we made different choices about our New York trip because parking and driving was going to be so difficult and expensive.
Parking in the CBD, this came from a Collier's report, that in the Central Business District is not comparable to our sort of competitor cities. It's more comparable to Jacksonville and Memphis.
Really?
In terms of parking costs per month.
And considering the size of Dallas.
Which means it's incredibly cheap to park here, which is essentially an incentive for people to drive, which just creates more congestion, more traffic.
That's really interesting. I remember taking my sister to college in Boston, and the Bed Bath & Beyond had a pay lot and just being blown away because I'd grown up in Florida and had lived in Texas before. And that's just reality in a lot of big cities, right?
Yeah, the land is too valuable.
My guests this hour are DART board member Patrick Kennedy and Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia. They are both going to be a part of D Magazine's Urbanism Symposium. Join the conversation by calling us at 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERAThink. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. My guests are DART board member Patrick Kennedy and Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia, and we're talking about urbanism in Dallas. Friday morning at 8:20, KERA's Vice President of News Rick Holter talks with Brent Brown of the Trinity Park Conservancy about plans to create one of the country's largest urban parks. That's during this week's Friday conversation. So I want to go ahead and get to the phones now. We have a lot of people interested in, you know, the new urbanism Dallas and how it's going to work. So first, we'll go to Sean in South Dallas. Sean, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Sure, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I do live in South Dallas. I actually kind of live in the Fair Park area. And, you know, what I do notice is that the bus services and stuff are, you know, they're poor people, really. And the problem with it is they don't run frequently enough. And I think I totally have to agree with that we need more density within our cities. And actually, if we did have more density here, that would put us apart from all the suburban areas that don't have that.
So do you think density would just totally change how public transit works around here?
Yeah, density is one of the key driving factors in transit ridership and in an efficiency of transit. And I would completely agree with the caller that frequency is needed, and we're working on that right now.
That's really interesting. Let's also talk to Sanjay now. Sanjay in Dallas has another transportation-related question. You go ahead with your question.
Yeah. I see a lot of expansion roads and adding more tolls to the roads. I think that's not going to be enough for future growth. Is there any plan to put like subway system to connect to between cities like San Antonio, Austin, Houston, between Dallas and between the cities to Salt Lake, to Plano, Irving?
Do we know anything about that?
Well, I don't know about a subway system, but there have been a number of different attempts to create super corridors that would connect Dallas with San Antonio and Austin along I-35. And then we have a project that is out in the market right now to connect Houston with Dallas. And, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar project. It's, I think, about $18 billion. Mm-hmm. But they're working hard on raising the money and going through all of the federal and state approvals. And I think it would be a terrific opportunity for both cities to link up. Imagine being able to get to Houston in about an hour and a half from downtown Dallas. You could literally commute there for work, or vice versa. And you know, why would you ever get on I-45 if you could take or candidly on a short haul flight, when you could just go through security very quickly down in downtown Dallas and end up in Houston in an hour and a half and not have to worry about weather delays?
Related to the caller's question about a subway, we are working on what is a project called D2 at DART, which would be the second downtown rail line. And it is intended to be underground through the entirety of downtown. And what it means is the four rail lines that we currently have all converge on one trunk line through the center of downtown. And we can only fit so many trains through there. We're basically at capacity right now, which means we can't improve frequency throughout the rail system. We're working on the bus side right now, but until we have that second line through downtown, which we're hoping to have done by 2024, we then can improve frequency through the entire system. So it's a line that's fundamental to our growth as a region, because it'll add so much more capacity.
Patrick, one of the things you talked about in your piece for D that was in the urbanism issue was kind of the concept of encouraging things like block parties and pop-up markets. Should we be looking at public streets differently than we do now?
I completely agree with that streets are not just for vehicular throughput. Interstate highways, yes, you don't want to be playing Frogger across one of those. But we do have to think about our streets different, and we've been sort of governed by this mindset that's pervaded public policy of vehicular level of service, and that gets ranked from A through F, and A means best theoretically, right? There's no traffic delay whatsoever at the intersections or at the signals, but the traffic engineer's level of service, A, would be an F to the economist, right? On the flip side, the A for the economist, where there's the most activity and energy and tax base happening around an area, would be an F for the traffic engineer. And so we have to calibrate our places that we're trying to create with the right kind of policies and metrics to allow those to be produced, so we're not just trying to move cars as fast as possible.
And that's kind of similar to a question that Robert in Dallas has about just kind of looking at the neighborhood itself. Robert, go ahead with your question.
I just want to say that I'm surprised that there's not a major effort to persuade people in the city to get to know their neighbors. There's nothing more important than that. You're talking about development and land use and density and different business models and all that stuff, and you're not saying anything about just getting to know your neighbors.
What do you think?
Well, I think I actually agree with the caller. I mean, if you think about our daily lives, if you're in a single family home with a garage, you leave your hermetically sealed, climate controlled house, and you go into your little pod, and the music is perfect in your pod, and the temperature's perfect, and then the cargo bay opens up and you drive out usually into another garage, right? That where there's no contact with other humans or weather, and then you go into an elevator, which is another pod that is climate controlled, and the music is perfect, and then it opens up into your office, and you go into your office, and you really don't ever meet your neighbor in that process because you repeat the same process over again, and you do that for years and years and years. So I there's a valid point that the caller's making about isolation. And the fact that many people, because we don't have subways, because we don't walk along streets, we don't come into contact with folks in community. And that's why I think Patrick's point about creating events at public spaces and the ability for people to come together is really important.
In housing design, we talk about a concept called pride of place. And in the housing structure, what has the pride of place in the design? Is it the parking garage that's right out front and center? It's the biggest thing that you see. Or is it the front porch that is welcoming for others to walk up? And it becomes that sort of semi-public or semi-private space where neighbors can meet. And so it really comes down to not just housing design, but neighborhood design. And do those places foster social connections with each other? Because there's a study in San Francisco that found that certain different type of streets, people knew their neighbors more than others, and one of the underlying factors was traffic speed.
So what can you do to push yourself a little bit? I mean, I'm assuming not everybody has to go straight from their little house into the garage, into their parking garage, you know, like in a Wall-E tube from that Pixar movie. Should you push yourself if you can walk to the corner store, you know, once a month to get a few non-perishables? Should you get a dog so you have to walk the blocks in your neighborhood more? What can you do to kind of force this, even maybe in a neighborhood that's not perfectly built for, you know, being knitted together?
Yeah, you don't want to force anybody to do something that they're not comfortable with, right? But they have to have that opportunity, and that really is where it comes down to neighborhood design and street design and housing design. But also, are those third places there where people can go and meet others and bump into somebody and have a conversation? And that really comes down to overall community design as well as the coding, the land use zoning. And does that foster and facilitate and even make it legal to build these kind of neighborhoods? Because that's one of the biggest barriers to build a lot of sort of the duplex type buildings, mixed use buildings, granny flats in the back, or what we call accessory dwelling units. Are those even legal to build? And we have to make sure that we can do that, because that's really where the social capital comes from.
Rafael, do you think events like National Night Out, you know, things that are kind of standardized, do they work, or are they too artificial to make much of a difference for people getting to know their neighbors?
Oh, no, not at all. I really do think they work. And, you know, I make it a point to hit every neighborhood association that invites me. It's a good way to meet folks. And, you know, I feel the excitement and the grit and the energy of community when I do block walking, whether it's for a community effort or for my political campaign. That's when I feel most connected to my friends and neighbors, because you're knocking on their doors, you're seeing some of the struggles that they're experiencing, the challenge of getting old alone in a home. Those are the things that you run across, you know, where I had a sweet lady invite me into the house the other day, and she said, and she all she wanted to do was play the piano for me. And I was thinking, gosh, I've got to hit 10 more houses on this block, right? and she just wanted me to sit for 30 minutes so she could play the piano for me. So the caller's point really resonated with me. And I like him, lament the fact that we don't do a good enough job in getting around our neighbors. Neighbors, National Night Out, Bastille Day in Oak Cliff. I'm a real homer for North Oak Cliff. Mardi Gras in Oak Cliff. All these kinds of festivals that we do are designed, you know, not just to have fun, but so to allow us to get to know each other.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. So, you both kind of mentioned this when we were chatting during the break, but talk to me about the role of technology. How is that going to change the way that we, you know, build and redevelop our communities?
So there's a professor named Tony Seba. I don't know if you've caught some of his work. I'll send you a link, Patrick. He theorizes that we are going to be in an all-electric, all-autonomous vehicle environment by 2030. That's very, very aggressive. Let's say he's off by 20 years. Okay, or 30 years. It's right around the corner. Autonomous vehicles are here. They're just going to get better. That is going to change our parking needs. It's going to change our land use. And I think there's a great opportunity. So when we do planning today, we shouldn't just do planning for today. We also need to be thinking about the future and what happens when cars drive themselves and use the road more efficiently, and where you're doing ride sharing potentially. And you need to expend less transportation dollars on transportation, highway transportation facilities. Where are there some opportunities to redirect funding? I mean, I'm sure DART is way out ahead on this stuff, but the future is really now. We need to be thinking about it.
Well, I can't speak for the agency, but as an urban planner and designer, I get this question a lot, and I think about it a lot, and nobody has the exact right answer because we're sort of, you know, walking off a cliff, and we'll see where it happens. And I wrote a little bit about this in the article, that the question is, what's the center of the universe? And for the last 70 years, we've been designing the car to be the center of the universe. And I said that driverless tech, AI, is not necessarily a new technology. It's just an advancement of an old technology, which is still the car. And presumably, let's assume that the tech figures it out and the liability issues are all worked out and it's perfectly safe. That doesn't answer the question of how do we maintain all the infrastructure, because we've got backlogs of billions and trillions around the country of maintenance needs because of that tax base to tax burden imbalance. It also doesn't necessarily solve the places – does it create places that we love? It may, because it could make parking irrelevant, and so we could remove parking and start to redevelop those kind of places, or redevelop old parking garages that are structurally able to support that. And if we're building new parking garages, they better be adaptable in the future. But those are all the kinds of things that we are thinking about and should be thinking about.
Here's kind of a two-part question. My producer and I were chatting about this before the show, but first of all, do you think the big box store, is it going to eventually just be a relic of the past? I mean, we see so many of the large store chains having problems. Do you think that's on the way out? Any ideas with digital, online shopping?
Look, I think retail's in trouble, I mean, long-term. And, a lot of the big box stores are moving to online operations. You can get just about anything you want on Target online or Walmart online, and so I think over time all retailers, not just big boxes, will be moving to online models and will be run more as logistics operations than retail operations.
Yeah, we're massively overbuilt in terms of retail square footage. I think the country as a whole has about 10 times the amount of retail square footage per capita of like the next largest country in terms of retail, which is Germany. So I see that as really just land banking, and I think those businesses probably see their land as land banking for some other future kind of opportunity or redevelop to sell to some other kind of development opportunity. But I think part of retail, too, is that there has to be an experience to it. Either you want that convenience that you can just click and it shows up at your door later that day, or you're going to a place to, browse and window shop or just be around other people, that there is that kind of experience to it. And you don't need all the warehousing in that space as well, which creates a lot less need for space.
And then just quickly before we get to the end here, so if we have big box stores that took up a lot of space with parking and just the structure itself going away, I mean, just begs the question, what should go there? I mean, that big vacancy, it's kind of like a scar. And what should be built in its place?
Well, it depends entirely on its location. Like, there's no one answer. You have to see sort of where it is in its context. There could be opportunities for mixed-use housing redevelopment, especially if it's in sort of an infill kind of an area. There could be opportunities where there may not be any value to that land anymore, and the highest, best use might be agriculture or something like
that's right.
Or power generation with solar panels. We don't know yet, but you have to sort of evaluate sort of that land on a case-by-case basis.
We were speaking this hour to Texas State Representative Rafael Anchia and DART Board member Patrick Kennedy. They are both involved in tomorrow's D Magazine Urbanism Symposium. Thank you both so much for being here. What an interesting conversation.
Thanks, Courtney. So much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.